This is the Angry GM, and it is apparently still October for at least, like, 29 hours left in October. And this is the mostly monthly live chat for the month of October in the year of 2024, a year that continues to just kick my ass. You can probably tell from the tenor and tone and cadence of my voice that I am feeling a bit under the weather, as I have been now for a bit, and that is why, well, I did not want to cancel or reschedule the live chat again. I was forced to push it off from last week. So I am here and we are doing this. But I am not going to lie. I am not nearly as prepared as I would like to be for this. So we're just going to kind of wing it and see what happens. And I didn't really even get to go through the thread and do things, you know, and then, like, scripts. I'll take questions from the thread. I'll chat with people in the audience because there are at least people here in the audience. So hello, everybody, and welcome, and thanks for hanging out. And I'm sorry about the last-minute reschedule. I guess I could start with that and the saga of Biscuit, since I've been saying mysterious things about Biscuit in the Discord chat, and many of you seem to like her. In fact, I don't blame you for liking her more than you like me, but that's also because you don't have to live with her. And as adorable as she is, she's also kind of a giant pain in the ass, and she's somewhat neurotic. But then again, she is my cat, so that is to be expected, but last week, I ended up once again at the emergency veterinary clinic up in Green Bay, which is about 45 minutes away from here. And then I ended up pulling a couple of all-nighters, staying up with her. And this whole thing has been really, really stupid and annoying, honestly. No, that was not last week. That was... oh, man, I don't even remember. Like, wow, the dates are just all a mess now. But it did, like, so, like, it's been going on for 6 weeks now with Little Biscuit. It started with her over-grooming her tummy and licking all the hair off her tummy, which at the time it seemed to be due to stress. But then she was nibbling and chewing on it, and she managed to break the skin and give herself an infection. And her, you know, like all the vets around here, her regular vet is so backed up that you can't get an appointment there for like a month and a half. So it was the urgent care clinic and the emergency hospital for her. That's the only way I was going to get it looked at. And it cleared up a bit and things were going well and they put her on medication, but she was so stressed by everything that then her bladder kind of shut down, which is a very dangerous condition for a cat. If they get a urinary blockage, they can actually die from that within 24 hours. So there was that frantic thing, and then things seemed to get better, and then it got worse again. And then I had to keep her in one of these soft collars so that she couldn't chew at it. But she doesn't tolerate that really well, so I had to keep a really, really close eye on her and make sure that she was eating and drinking and going potty, and I had to keep her very, very clean and clean up her little hiney butt after pottying and, you know, all the things. And that's just been ongoing for about 6 weeks now, and then it keeps reemerging. And finally, the other day, I took her out of the collar, and she's still a bit worked up because she's on she's on steroids for anti-inflammation, and she's still got some antibiotics in her system. But now being out of the collar, she's suddenly rambunctious until today when she just slept through the whole day. So she burned through a whole bunch of energy and then just sort of passed out for most of the day. And of course, I'm keeping a close eye on everything because she's still really over-grooming her tummy. And now I have to be worried about maybe there's a fungal infection or something. And that's just the whole saga of Biscuit. And it's like, you know, I'm not I'm not a parent. She's not a kid, but it's good training because, you know, the only thing worse than this is, you know, the sick kid and all of that. So, you know, I will not claim I have it worse than any parent at all, but it's certain, there is a certain aspect of parenting to it all. And she's my little buddy and I love her. And, you know, honestly, she's helping me out a lot, deal with things because it's still been a very, very rough year. I did not realize how difficult it would be to adjust to not having a partner in my life anymore after living with someone for 7 years and then having that. And then, you know, and as I talked about last month, there's still the issues. Like, you know, I was in the hospital a couple of times and my health has been kind of shot and I'm still not really taking care of myself the way I should. And I think November is, I'm going to start back on Weight Watchers. I had very good experiences with Weight Watchers in the past, as long as I stuck with it. Though they have changed their program a few times. And the last time I was doing it, I wasn't quite as happy with it. But, you know, I have to get my weight down. I have to keep my blood pressure under control. I have to keep my blood sugar under control because I keep losing control of that. And I have type 2 diabetes, but I keep it very well managed with diet and exercise until I stop, and then gonna end up wrecking myself again if I'm not careful. So I got to do all this stuff. And then there was the whole thing of, you know, benchmarks and trying to hit some positive milestones before the end of the year so that I can feel like I'm making progress. And then there was that really glum, doom and gloom thing I said last month, where it's basically like, if I don't figure out how to make all this work, I just have to shut this down and go get a real job. Like, this is not a real job. Honestly, I won't say I put more hours in at this than I ever put in the accounting world, because the accounting world is kind of brutal on hours. But I joke that this isn't a real job, but, you know, I do put a lot of time and energy and effort into it. So, yeah, I have to stop joking that this is not a real job. It is. But anyway, I did also promise that we weren't going to do a whole bunch of glum and depressing stuff this month, but I am still, you know, in the throes of recovering and still struggling, and I will continue to be struggling for a while yet. But things are moving forward, and even though it's once again one of those months where a bunch of content all comes out at the end of the month, I am kind of happy with the content I've thrown out, though. I did sort of change the article that's going to pop out tomorrow. And I don't know when people are listening to this recording, so I guess I'm talking to the people in the Discord chat here. The article that's going to pop out tomorrow is a shorter little one-off article, because I really needed to do more outlining and planning on the two big lessons that are coming, like true scenario designery. As I introduced the other day, we are now moving into a period where we will be discussing some pretty hefty and pretty weird ideas and looking at adventure design in ways that I don't think generally people look at it this way. I mean, you know, I could be wrong. I've not read everything everybody's ever written on adventure design, but, you know, I am kind of like encouraging people to look at it more like designing a board game, or designing a video game, or designing a video game level, than designing a role-playing game adventure, so that you get the underlying game elements in there first, and then layer the role-playing stuff around them. And I had a couple of conversations now, because I did some proofread alouds and the after-action proofread, or the after-action chat. After I stop recording the proofread aloud, I always end up chatting for a little while, and some discussions various places around the server and a couple of private discussions with people. I've basically been previewing the basic ideas of the next topic in true scenario design, which is going to be, I'm calling it winning and losing. Okay, except that the secret is it's not really winning and losing. Winning and losing is an easy way to state it. What it really is it's about setting the different outcomes for your whatever, for your encounter, for your adventure, for your for your scene. Because eventually we're going to have to start talking about better ways to structure adventures, and I'm going to stick with the encounter, scene, adventure structure. Not where an encounter is a, like, not that whole bullshit I put forth years ago that was totally wrong, where I said a scene is an encounter that isn't, like, that there's no conflict. That's a nonsense way of looking at things. You don't need conflict to have an encounter. That's kind of a meaningless thing to think about. An encounter is any time the players are interacting with elements of the game world, whether there is a challenge involved or not. If they're just chatting with a merchant that they met on the road, that's an encounter. Even if there's no conflict, even if there's no challenge, you know, that's still an encounter. But then the scene structure goes above the encounter, where the scene is like, okay, so this is the scene where the party is in town. And while they're in town, they may have a couple of different goals and they may talk to different people and do different things. And then there's the scene of traveling through the wilderness. And you could actually break that down however you wanted. Like, you know, there's a scene on the road, and then there's the scene in traveling through the forest. And then there's a scene in the valley. And then there's a scene, then there's the actual dungeon scene. Okay, so it's kind of a way of breaking down the adventure into chunks, and each scene kind of needs all of its elements of game design. And then, you know, each encounter needs its elements of game design, and then the adventure as a whole needs the elements of game design. And so what I'm really going to be talking about, even though I'm calling it winning and losing, is more about outcomes in general. Because you can have an adventure that is technically unwinnable, if you want to say it like that. Like, maybe you make an account, the first boss in any Soulsborne game is always unwinnable, right? There's different outcomes there. You either get smashed or you escape. You can do that, you know, in a role-playing game. You can design an encounter where all of the outcomes are different flavors of what you might traditionally call losing, you know, if like from this standpoint of was it victory or was it a setback kind of a thing? All the outcomes could be setbacks, hypothetically, you know, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. The fact that you have different outcomes and that the players can mitigate the level of setback. Like if you have a town that's burning down, right? This is a scene where the town is burning down and the goal is for the players to limit the destruction as much as possible. Save people from burning buildings, reduce the spread of the fire, raise the alarm, whatever things they might do around the town. The end result is no matter what, that fire is going to do some damage. And so the only thing in front of the players is how much can they limit the damage? It's like, how much do you limit the loss? That's the sort of thing where it's not really useful to think in terms of winning and losing, but in terms of this scalable outcome of how, like, what level of destruction happens before the situation ends, and how do the players prevent that? And likewise, you can have adventures that technically you can't lose. I mean, if the adventure, and I use this as an example, I'm kind of rambling now and giving a preview again, even though I said I wasn't going to do that. But fine, it's whatever. We're just talking about whatever we want tonight. So feel free, by the way, to chamber up any questions with the good old question marked emote icon. And I will go through the thread and tackle some of the questions there. But just use that red emote icon if you want to ask questions. Emoticon? Oh, my God. Emoji. Emoticon. Like, what am I? Like, what is this, 2005? Put your emoticons on the messenger. But yeah, and just put the little question mark at the beginning, not the end of your question. But yeah, so, and then I'll see them as they come by. But anyway, So you can have an adventure that has no loss conditions, like explore the dungeon and get as much treasure out of it as you can, right? I mean, that's, you're not going to lose that adventure. You're just plundering, notwithstanding getting killed. But that's a whole other separate thing. Am I on, like, I'm getting some weird flashy things from Discord here. So, I am going to ask, like, if you're going to ask me questions, you know, ask actual serious questions. Don't use it to make wisecracks. Because otherwise, like, the reason for the red question mark is it does draw my attention. And if it's just drawing my attention for a joke, you've now interrupted my train of thought. So, you know, thanks, Ralphius. That was cute, but don't do that. Anywho, so, anyway, so between that and the whole tackling the other half of the death lesson in true scenario design, the I need some more outlining time on both of those things. And so we're going to do a little one-off, and it's almost done. It'll be done tomorrow. I did get a little delayed because, unfortunately, Radder Crash, who does the audio remixing, he's indisposed for a couple of days rather suddenly. And so I have to do my own audio remixing to get the proofread allowed, and I don't want to fall behind on those either. So I've been dividing my time there, and I am not as fast at mixing the audio or anything else. Anyway, so that's what's happening. Tomorrow will be the fourth and final article for the month. And then this month, I also have to make the back, in November, I mean, when I say this month, in November now, the back end changes to Patreon have to be finalized. And I have to press the buttons on that. This is the last month where I can get away with not doing it. So, but again, not going to be a major big change for anybody, I don't think. I will put out a separate announcement if I think it's going to affect anyone. The biggest change you're going to notice is going to be on Patreon. Now the support tiers are not going to be listed on a per article basis, but on a per month basis. So suddenly it's going to look like my prices went up by 4. When really they didn't. It's still, you know, everybody who pledged their support, you're going to be pledging the same support that you've pledged all along. It's just now the prices are going to be listed monthly instead of article-ly, so to speak. So anywho, so there's that. That's got to get done. And then we have a Slap chat coming in the next week or two, right? Yeah, I did have, I think I said that I'm going to do the Slap chat next Wednesday night, and I'm going to stick to that because one of the most important things going forward for me is it's getting too easy for me to kind of like cancel things. I hate to admit this. My gaming group has been suffering for this more than anything, but you get into the habit of where you're not feeling well and you're going through struggles and you have excuses like, oh, I pulled an all-nighter because I was at the animal hospital or whatever. And then, you know, the next day you can say, well, I have an excuse to cancel. The problem is every time you have an excuse to cancel something or push something off or change a deadline, every time you actually do it, it makes it easier to do it the next time. And the severity of the thing that that's cancellation worthy becomes less and less. So whereas, you know, it's like it would be a hell or high water emergency, then it's like, okay, well, it's not a huge emergency, but I can cancel because, you know, and then you get to that habit. So I have to break the habit of canceling and rescheduling things in general, in my gaming group with stuff like announced events here and also with other personal things. This is just one of the tasks for November, and the other task for November is getting myself back on the Weight Watchers and exercise diet routine, and I will be blaring about that in the angry feed because, you know, I don't know, for some reason people keep telling me I should do that because it helps them, and it is good for me to say, hey, you know, like celebrate my victories. So there we go. Anyway, that's enough about that. I did want to briefly talk about D&D 2024. And specifically the 2024 Player's Handbook. And not the Dungeon Master's Guide yet, but also things in general. I did pick up the 2024 Player's Handbook. It's actually been sitting here for a little while. And I have not actually read through it yet. But the thing is, I am going to... obviously, because of my position, because of what I do, I have to adopt D&D 2024 until I have replacement products like a game of my own and stuff like that. So I don't have a choice. I can't sit here and hate on it. You know, and honestly, there's really no margin in hating on it anyway. Obviously, it has its strengths, it has its weaknesses, but even though I have been pretty down on D&D 5th edition in general, it has not prevented me from actually writing about D&D 5th edition, providing analysis about it, content, and all of that stuff. And the same is going to be for 2024. It's just I'm going to have to accept it, and I'm going to have to learn to live with it and like it. And for the most part, just by leafing through the Player's Handbook, it's no more onerous than D&D 5e. Well, I realize that's a very that's such a backhanded compliment. You know, it's not really any worse. You know, I mean, people make a big stink about certain things, presentational issues like, you know, the whole, oh, now there's research as an action. And I really don't think that's as big a problem as it's being made out to be. It's not the way I would like things presented, but, you know, it's not going to break the game any more than any of the other presentational issues. And even things like, I mean, there's some stupid character abilities, like the whole, you know, the Barbarian Rage, adding your strength modifier to your perception check and how nonsensical that is. But it's like, yeah, I mean, that's par for the course for D&D racial or D&D class abilities anyway. So, you know. But what I do want to say, and I'm not going to go into a full review or anything right now, because I haven't started running D&D 2024 yet, though I am making inroads on that front. Though one of the things that's limiting me from doing it is the Monster Manual, for some reason, is coming out last. It's not coming out until, I think it's slated for February. And it's, like, I don't know what the hell to, how the hell I'm supposed to run a game without a bestiary. And, you know, people say, well, it's backwards compatible. You could just use the D&D 5th edition Monster Manual. And I guess that's technically true, but they did talk about making significant changes to the monster design. Like, for one thing, not relying on multi-attack as the damage balancing factor. And since, like, every monster and its cousin had multi-attack, then that alone is just going to represent a significant change. So, you know, it's not like I can just pull monsters from 5th edition and say that, oh yeah, I'm testing 2024. So I don't know, I'll figure things out. But one thing I do want to say is that the Player's Handbook, apart from the artwork, I find the artwork really off-putting. I'm going to say that. I find the art design really off-putting. But the actual arrangement of the book, how things are presented, it is very similar to the D&D 2014 Player's Handbook, but immensely clearer and easier to navigate. And there are just so many little things they did that they should have done to be, like, there's pictures of every weapon and suit of armor, which is just, it seems like a small thing, but it's so important. And there's actually descriptions of all the tools and all the equipment. You know, the spell organization is light years better. The tables where they list the class spells are also really, really well done. So it's just, you know, from a graphic design perspective, it doesn't look super different. Like, if you open it up, you can see that it's pretty much the same basic layout. And yet, it's completely different. Like, it's game-changingly different. Even things like just cranking up the contrast. The background colors on the pages are lighter, and the text stands out much better. The page numbers stand out much better. All of the chapter labels stand out much better. The highlighting in the tables doesn't get lost in the pages. And there's a lot more with dividers and a lot and little blocks of information that just all make it very much easier to read. So I really do want to acknowledge that. And I have to acknowledge it because I really have been very down on the D&D 5e's organization or, you know, presentation, right? It's like, you know, I made a lot of complaints about how hard it was to navigate those books and find things and how badly laid out they were. So when they do it right, I have to acknowledge, nope, you did a good job. It's only fair. Stu is saying, I think the art is cool. It just doesn't capture what I'm looking for in a D&D game. Well, yeah, then it fails. If it's art that doesn't, if it doesn't fit the D&D game, then it's bad art. I'm sorry. You know, and that's half of where I'm coming from right there, is just this is not a game of fantasy adventure anymore. Okay, and I have used this phrase several times now, and I am going to continue to use this phrase, and I know some people find this phrase offensive, but all of the art looks like a cosplayers at a Seattle Renaissance street fair. Okay, and that's the whole player's handbook. Most of the imagery is of characters, you know, just like flamboyantly displayed character. Okay. There are not scenes of exciting, and there are a few scenes of exciting adventure, but there is not much. It is very, very, like the plates that start some of the chapters off are actually okay. I also find a lot of the character designs just awful. There's just so many, like, modern hairstyles and modern looks that it's just such a turnoff for me. You know, like, can we take a moment to acknowledge that the whole side shave thing, with one side of the head shaved and then the hair flipped over, or else both sides of the hair shaved, on anyone. On, you know, this is not a gender thing. This is just, that is a hideous haircut that needs to die. And I don't know where people are getting their buzz cuts from in you know, Faerun, but whatever. Really hate that shit, you know. But anyway, that's it. I've said my piece on that. So I'm going to start going through the monthly live chat thread and take some of the questions that I can handle and also questions that were thrown out. Ralphius wants me to give a bunch of quick and dirty examples of setups that encourage the players to assign quests to themselves. No, that's something that I'll do in articles. I mean, come on. I'm going to do whole articles on that. That is not something I can just rattle off. I wish I could. You know? But I gave you one already. I think actually technically I've given out three, but you'll have to go find them. So let's see. What are some things that I can tackle here? Noited asks how you share world lore and background information without resorting to exposition dumps. Are there times when exposition is necessary? There are, of course, always times when exposition is necessary. Unfortunately, your job as a game master is to tell the players what their characters know about the world, and there is no way to do that sometimes without directly saying what they know. One of the most important tricks is to share facts when they're relevant. So, like, if I want to share information about an order of knights, okay, then I'm, you know, because it's going to be important in an adventure, I'm going to have the party meet a knight, right, who's wearing the regalia of their order. And I'm going to describe the regalia of the order. I'm going to say, you know, his surcoat is, his surcoat is crimson, and in the middle of it, you know, it has, a crown with a sword through it, you know, something like that. And then I will say, you know that this is the symbol of the whatever order, a group of knights who are renowned for crusading against evil. I mean, that doesn't make sense for crowns and swords, but whatever. Crusading against evil and with a reputation, especially for fighting undead or whatever little bits and pieces of information. And the key is, of course, to share only the minimum amount of information that you need to share. Because players aren't going to pay attention to most of the exposition anyway. I could give them the entire history of this knightly order, but they're not going to pay attention to most of it. They're only going to hear about a third of what I say. So then my best bet is to just limit what I tell them to the stuff that they actually need to know and let them fill in the other blanks. You can also do a lot of stuff with like implied backstory, like, you know, if it's a broken crown with a sword through it, but they are a group of, you know, exiled, like, crusaders, that might raise a question of, like, why are, you know, what's their symbol mean? And if the players are interested, they can ask about that. Or the players can learn more about the order by interacting with the knight. And one of the things to do with this, one of the things to keep in mind with this trick is that if you only share information the moment it is relevant, then sharing the information will telegraph something that is going to happen. You know, like if I were to suddenly start rattling off information about undead weaknesses, then the players are going to be thinking, you know, fellas, I think in a moment we're going to encounter some undead. So when there's a situation where you need to get information to the party because you know it's going to be relevant later in the adventure, like they need to know the weaknesses of mummies, okay? The trick is to find another scene where that information is relevant enough that you could share it there. And then later when they run into a mummy, then they do the, well, holy crap, we just learned all about mummies from that other thing that happened. You know, if I was doing an adventure and I was going to surprise the players with a mummy, but I wanted them to know that, like, mummy rot, because they should know mummy rot because it's a very serious thing, so they should at least have some kind of warning, okay? Then, like, maybe 2 weeks before I do that session, if I can manage to plan it that far in advance, they will meet an adventurer during downtime in a tavern whose arm is gone. And I will draw their interest into that conversation, or even have the adventurer approach their table, you know, and say, hey, buy a drink for a down on your luck adventurer. And I will play up the missing arm, like he'll fumble with his goblet when they buy him a drink. And I'll say, you know, he fumbles with his goblet, and from the way he's moving his body, it's clear he's not used to not having the arm yet. And you drop enough of that shit, and eventually one of your players are going to say, what happened to your arm? And then he's going to say, well, I used to be an adventurer like you until I took a mummy in the elbow. And then my whole arm just rotted off and clerics couldn't save it in time and yada, yada, yada. I was eventually, whatever. End scene. 2 weeks later, the players open the sarcophagus up. and there is a mummy, and they're like, oh shit, that one-armed guy, he told us about this. You know, that's a trick you use if you need to get information in advance. Okay, this, by the way, is one of the important things that, or this is why I say, excuse me if I'm fumbling a little bit with my words. I'm suffering a lot of brain fog, and there's still a lot of lack of sleep on my end, so my thoughts are still a little scattered about. But anyway, let me try that again. I keep harping on how good game design principles will improve any game you want to run, and that you don't want to rely on improvisation alone, even if you're a strong improviser, because you can't back out and do that sort of big picture shit that game design lets you do. This is an example of a superpower that comes from forward thinking. Because I know there's a mummy in the future, I can teach the players mummies in a very subtle, completely unrelated way a week or two early. And then when they encounter the mummy, instead of me just having to make die rolls, like, it's just roll. Okay, you know about mummies. Or me just saying, it's a mummy. Let me rattle off all that you know about mummies. Instead, I can sneak that information into the game a week in advance in a way that the players don't immediately necessarily connect with the mummy until the mummy happens, and then they don't feel like I have contrived my game because I snuck information to them. Instead, what they feel is, and gosh, aren't we brilliant for remembering that guy? And I sure am glad we bought him a drink and asked him about his arm. We sure are smart adventurers. So, you know, the trick with information management is knowing what information you want to share and find, like, sneaking it in when it's relevant, unless that's going to give shit away, in which case you find ways to sneak it in before it's relevant in completely different ways. Okay. I don't remember what the question was, but I'm going to guess there was a good answer in there. Let's see. Knox asked an interesting question that I did want to tackle too. Let's say I want to invent a cool new monster because Beholders and Mind Flayers had to start somewhere. Which, I mean, yes, they did. Where might I start if I wanted to create a new monster, not mechanically, but thematically? And you start the same place you start when you're designing literally anything. Okay, the first thing you should do is describe the thing you want to design. Okay? You can, like, if you write it down, it's called a design statement. Like, I'm going to design a new monster for my game, and this monster will, basically, it is a plant-based monster that feeds on blood. It is barely mobile, but as it consumes blood, it becomes faster and faster, and because the blood engorges it, it becomes engorged with blood or something, I don't know, I'm just, like, shitballing here, spitballing, not, yeah. I'm not doing the dung beetle thing. I'm just spitballing here. But, like, whatever, okay? So you describe whatever the hell it is that you're trying to make, okay? And then you give it a couple of passes. Like, after you describe it, you walk away and you have a cup of coffee or a beverage of choice. Then you come back to it, you read what you wrote, and then you describe it again in a little bit more detail. You know, once you get to a point where you look at that piece of paper and you're like, yep, that's the thing I want to build. I want to build blood balloon plants that inflate like water balloons as they suck blood out of creatures and then become more and more dangerous. Which, that was repulsive, and I'm sorry. You know, now, the trick, too, is to remember that you really only need one strong theme to hang, and then everything else kind of hangs off of kind of hangs off the theme. As a general rule, you don't want more than one or two things. You know, and the, it depends on to your use. Like when you're describing what you're trying to design, you should also describe like what you plan to do with this. Like, what are my blood balloon plants going to be? Are we going to have a blood balloon boss monster? Or are these blood balloon minions that drift through the swamp of lost hope that the players are going to stumble over and step on and pop? That's awful, too. Sorry. But anyway, you know, like, because then that also... I'm naming that stuff Tickweed and using it sometime in the future. Yeah, Tickweed, that's a great name for it. Feel free. But anyway, like, are these little minions? Are they mooks? Is it a boss? Are they, you know, what role do they fill in the game? Once you've described, okay, thematically, this is what they are, now figure out what role they're going to fill in the game. What are you planning to do with them? At least the first time. You know, because once you have a good thing, you can build on it from there. It's like, you know, maybe you introduced them one time in the Swamp of Lost Hope, and then the players went into wandering through, like, the Bubble Glump dungeon later on, and you're like, man, I need swamp monsters. Oh, I can do more with those blood balloon monsters. What if there was a blood balloon boss? Like a giant blood balloon pulsing away in the heart of this dungeon, you know? Or something like that. And then, you know, and then you can build on the theme from there. But figure out what your initial use is for it and write that down too. Because every game construct, specifically every monster, but literally every game construct, it has a carrying capacity. Okay? Each thing can only carry so much concept before it's crushed under the weight of all of its ideas. Okay? So, like, take the mind... Now, mind flayers are, you know, they are mastermind enemies, right? They're the villains in the shadows, or they're the big things. But they didn't start out that way, right? Initially, when the first mind flayers were created, I'm pretty sure, and I can't walk over to my books to find out about this, but I'm pretty sure that they were brain-eating predators, right? They'd skulk around, like it was a brain-eating monster. That was the initial concept. I want to build this, you know, but they were super intelligent too, but this all hangs into the brain theme, right? So it's like it's an intelligent, brain-eating mastermind. Probably was a mastermind, right? So then you can think, so what can we do with that? So it eats brains, obviously. It is super intelligent. So then what can I do with that? Okay, it's got psionic powers. Bam, done, and done, right? And that's enough for a mastermind. You've got three things there. It's a brain-eating abomination. It is a brilliant mastermind in the shadows. And it is psionic, right? Three concepts, and then you can build your mechanics from that. You know, my little blood balloon things, they're probably not great mooks, but like, you know, they're on the same level as goblins and stuff, because now there's two things about them. One is they drink blood, and two is they become more powerful as you fight them, right? Those are your two thematic elements. Done and done. Everything else has got to hang off of that. And then once you have your strong theme identified, like this is a theme of blood, this is a theme of life draining. So they're vampiric. So obviously, first of all, they're going to be like sickly red brown, right? And they're going to be veiny and pulsing. And then they're going to be like covered in thorns that look like bone white fangs, right? Because again, we're trying to do, okay, they're vampiric, they're blood sucking. You know, how do you capture that? They float around, you know, or whatever, or they crawl around on the ground. But there you go. Anyway, I have just now designed a monster. But that's it. Number one, design what the hell you're going to build. or describe what you're going to create, describe its role in the game, keep working at that description until you have, yes, that is the thing I'm going to build. I want to build that. Check it to make sure that you're not cramming more than one, two, or three things on it, depending if it's just a minor thing, a middling thing, or a big old thing, and then build the monster. And again, I hope that that kind of answered the question. I'm just scanning down to, like, Boro asked what my impression and exposure to D&D 2024 has been like, and I think I kind of handled that. Agent Carr asked me best or worst movie I've seen recently. I'm a terrible person to ask about movies. You should ask me about video games. I really don't watch movies much anymore or TV shows. I just don't. I don't go out to the movies like I used to, and I really don't care to pay for streaming services. And frankly, the movies that I have seen over the past 10 years, like I'm going to call it like most of the movies in the last decade have not made me want to go see more movies. Okay. I'm also very, very picky about movies. Also don't ask me about video games right now because, I'm not really playing anything. Like I kind of drift away. I started playing Sekiro for a little while, and then I forgot I was playing Sekiro. And then I just started drifting to just playing, like, oh, I have 10 minutes to play a game. Or not 10 minutes, but I have a half hour to waste playing a video game. So I will boot up my RetroPie on the TV, and I will play retro games. Funniest thing I did recently was I booted up Battletoads for the NES. A game which I have a very storied history with. And I was actually testing to see if I'm old yet. So, Battletoads for the NES by Rare, released in, let's see here, when did it come out? I'm going to say, what, 91? 1991, I was right. Okay. June 1991. Okay. It was a very important game in young Angry's life. I was 12 at the time? 12, 13 at the time. Somewhere around there. Yeah, that's about right. I was 13. Okay. Battletoads for the NES is the first video game I saved up for and purchased with my own money. Lawn mowing and doing odd jobs and stuff. Nintendo Power featured it extremely heavily. It looked awesome in Nintendo Power, and so I had to have it. And so it's the first video game that I didn't receive as like a Christmas present or a birthday present or whatever. It was the first video game that I actually just bought with my own money. And that was terrible because, hello, I am back. You probably, if you're listening to the recording, you may have noticed that there was a sudden cut in the audio. There were a little bit of technical difficulties because I had a cat's claw caught in my ear while I was trying to keep her from eating the microphone. Everything is back now and we are fine. And I think I was talking about my young Angry's experience with Battletoads for the NES, the first game he ever saved up for, and why that was terrible, because the game was impossibly difficult. In fact, it's famously difficult. Before Dark Souls came along and everything was the Dark Souls of whatever, everything was the Battletoads of whatever. In fact, Dark Souls was the Battletoads of Western action role-playing games. So anyway, it's a side-scrolling beat-em-up. It's very well animated. So it's a lot of cartoony over-the-top action. You take on the role of one of the three titular Battletoads who travel around the galaxy with their mentor, Professor T-Bird, and fighting evil, especially the evil queen, the Dark Queen. I think her name was just the Dark Queen. And her minion, Silas Volkmeyer, who is a computer programmer. Anyway, the story doesn't matter. So one of the Battletoads is captured by the Dark Queen along with a princess that the two of them were out joyriding together. And then you have to fight your way through 12 levels to rescue them. And at first it seems to be your standard 2.5D beat-em-up game, like your Double Dragons or your River City Rampages or what have you. But quickly, the variety in the gameplay becomes a little bit bonkers. So in the second level, it's a beat-em-up level, but you're on basically a bungee cord going down a pit and swinging back and forth, fighting things that come at you as you descend down the pit. And then the third level, the infamous level, it starts as a beat-em-up level down in a cave that looks like the inside of a brain for some reason. And you fight your way through some of the Dark Queen's rat minions. And then partway through the level, you jump on this speeder bike, little floating hover bike, and then you have to dodge something like 120 obstacles in 5 separate blocks that come at you in increasingly ridiculous speed. And this level became infamous because most people just never beat it. Like everybody who played Battletoads, the first two levels were fairly tame. You could get through them. And then you get to the third level, the Turbo Tunnel, and that was it. That was where everybody's game ended. I paid my own money for this game, though. So, you know, and as a kid, like $60, $70 in 1980s money, that was not a small amount of money. You know, that was a lot of chores and mowed lawns and babysitting and things, because I did it all. So I would not give up on the damn Turbo Tunnel. I did eventually get to the point where I could beat the Turbo Tunnel. And then after that is it's almost a 2D puzzle platformer level, which is the ice cavern. And then after that is an obstacle-filled surfboard course with a boss monster in the middle. And then there is the snake pit where you have to basically, the snakes are moving platforms through these instant kill spike pit trap, or these instant kill spikes are everywhere, and you have to jump from snake to snake and climb the snakes and maneuver to the exits in 4 increasingly complicated stages. And then there's a fighter plane in hell past electrical barbed wire. There's a sewer maze. There's a unicycle race course where you're being chased by a giant hypnotic boulder. There's a race up the Dark Queen's Tower. There's a race down the Dark Queen's Tower. And then there's another climb up another Dark Queen's Tower. I think there was another. Yeah. Anyway, so I never actually beat the game as a kid, but I was pretty famous amongst all my friends because I could get to something like level 9. And as I started to get older, you know, I kept my copy of Battletoads in my NES, obviously, because I love them, and, I love the NES anyway, and it got to be a tradition that every so often I would break out Battletoads and make sure I could still beat the Turbo Tunnel. Then once I started getting into my 20s and then my early 30s and, discovered emulation, I kept up the tradition, and it became a thing I did every year on my birthday. Every year on my birthday, I would play Battletoads and at least make sure I could beat the Turbo Tunnel. And I decided that as long as I could still beat the Turbo Tunnel, I was not yet old. The last 2 years, as far as I recall, I haven't done that. But just at random, there was a conversation about it in the video game channel, and I ended up bringing up Battletoads, or someone brought up Battletoads. I don't remember how Battletoads came up, and I told part of this story, and that inspired me to boot up Battletoads and see if I had gotten old yet. And I was happy to discover that I still have not gotten old. However, I did do something that I don't usually do after that, and as I kept playing for a little while to see, it was one of those things where I wonder how far I can still get in this game. Well, it turns out that all of those years of playing through the Turbo Tunnel and then saying, oh, well, I'm not old yet, and then turning off the game has completely erased my ability to play anything past the Turbo Tunnel. So I was absolutely demolished partway through the Ice Cavern, which is level 4. And so now I keep going. I was playing Battletoads a bit more. So when I have time, but I don't have much time for video gaming right now, so I haven't even been doing that very seriously. I did start playing, it's October, I should play some of the old Castlevania games, but that didn't last long either. Those are not my jam. Anyway, so that is the Angry Battletoads story. Let's see. Meanwhile, there were a couple of questions that got posted. Maybe I should do a Battletoad stream sometime, just for funsies, a little one-off stream. It's just like, let's see how far Angry can really get with Battletoads. I'll put in like an infinite lives code so I don't have to keep game overing and then starting from the beginning. But if I even try to do that, because I have gotten a few requests to, hey, do some more video game streaming just because it's fun to do the hangouts or it's fun to watch them later. And that is fun, and, you know, I enjoy doing it, and I love any excuse to hang out with the community because you guys are awesome. But, yeah, maybe we'll just boot up Battletoads one night and see how far we can get. You know, I really want to do, because I'm not sure how many people have an experience with it, I have a history with the game Shadowgate for the NES. So, anywho, there were a couple of questions that I scrolled past. I know one was from Arthur. So Arthur asked, in response to all my discussion about scenes and encounters and all of that stuff, this is a question that is going to have a complicated answer, even though it's the answer to the question is simple, but it's going to lead to a complicated discussion. The question is, where do dramatic questions fit into the current Church of Angry? And it is an excellent question because obviously, so many, 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 many years ago now, I wrote an article on encounter design. And in that article, I pointed out that when you make an encounter, one of the first things you want to consider is the dramatic question, okay, which in a movie or in a book or whatever, a dramatic question is the element of uncertainty that is set up at the beginning of a scene and resolved by the end of the scene. So when the characters go in to get information from someone and they walk into the bar because they need to go. Indiana Jones, he goes off to the mountains in Tibet to meet Marion Ravenwood because she had the medallion, right? That would help him find the staff of, help him find the Ark of the Covenant. So as he walks into the bar, the question is he going to get the medallion from Marion? By the end of the scene, we get the answer. He does get the medallion. And that's when the scene ends. The scene begins with the question of, is he going to get the medallion? It ends, I think it wasn't a medallion. It was the headpiece of the staff. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, so the whole point is an encounter is designed by being bookended with a dramatic question. Okay? It starts with the posing of a dramatic question. The goblins attack, do the players survive the goblin attack? Or do the players beat the goblins? Or do the players get past the goblins? And I made a lot of hay about how important it was to really drill down and look at the dramatic question. And then, you know, I think there were four elements that I said that, that came into an encounter, which was, I know there was a dramatic question and I know there was a source of conflict, right? And in that case, you know, in the Indiana Jones scene, there were two sources of conflict. The first source of conflict was Marion herself and Marion's anger toward Indy because of the bad blood they had left between them years before. And then the second source of conflict was also Nazis wanted the medallion also, right? And in the goblin case, like the source of conflict is the goblins want to defend their territory. And of course, source of conflict, the thing I pointed out with the source of conflict is that a source of conflict is not an object or a creature. It is a motivation. It is the reason why the thing is in the way. So it's not, Marion is not the source of conflict. The source of conflict is her unresolved anger at Indiana Jones that makes her not want to help him. And the Nazis are not a source of conflict, believe it or not. Sentences I never thought I'd say. The Nazis weren't really a source of conflict. It was their desire to also get the headpiece of the staff that brought them into conflict with Indy, because only one group could have the medallion. It was either going to be Indy or the Nazis. So the source of conflict is they want the medallion, Indy wants the medallion, thus there must be conflict. Just like Indy wants the medallion, Marion does not want to give him the medallion, so there is now a conflict. What both party, the things that parties want, the two parties involved can't both get what they want. Something has to change. You know, something has to give. The conflict has to be resolved in some way. You know, so that can be by a fight, it can be by an argument, it can be by compromise, it can be by persuasion. You know, in the end, Marion ends up teaming up with Indy. And meanwhile, Indy leaves, burns down the building with the Nazis trapped inside, and he runs away with the medallion, right? So that's the conflict resolution. But anyway, the point is, I was trying to analyze encounter building by that framework. And a number of people really found that analysis helpful and started using it as their framework to build encounters for years to come. In point of fact, Arcane Library, who put out a number of different D&D modules and then eventually published Shadow Dark. I think Shadow Dark was theirs, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. Shadow Dark was the Arcane Libraries. Thank you. Okay. And then eventually published Shadow Dark. In their modules, they explicitly use the dramatic question. I don't know if they call it explicitly the dramatic question of the encounter, but I know that their encounter framework calls out specifically, this is the element of the encounter that needs to be resolved. And when it is resolved, the encounter is, when it's resolved, the encounter is over. And I know that because I had conversations with one or two of them, because the Arcane Library is a they, I believe. Oh no, it's Kelsey Dionne. She is Arcane Library. I know she worked, like, she didn't do everything alone, but Kelsey was a fan of mine, and she absorbed that framework and started using it. Meanwhile, I kind of moved beyond that because it wasn't by itself enough. And it was actually looking at encounter design from a very story-focused way. Now, when you start really looking at things, story and game, like story design or narrative design and game design, have a lot of overlaps. They have to do a lot of the same things. So you start to discover when you really look at them that they're elements that they have in common, even if they call them different things. you know, both have a concept of pacing and both have a concept of rising action and release tension and what have you. They just come in different flavors. And whereas in stories, you call the unresolved issue that is attempting to be resolved the dramatic question. In gameplay, you call it a goal, right? So dramatic question still exists, okay, in the Church of Angry. But I have moved to a more game design focused approach where instead of breaking things down in terms of the dramatic question and the source of conflict, what I'm now referring to things as is you have a goal, you have challenges, a challenge being a source of conflict, a goal essentially defining the dramatic question. And then because we need to do things more complicated than a binary dramatic question, and this was one of the big limitations with the dramatic question, is a dramatic question is essentially binary. One of the missing pieces there is the element of you can have numerous different outcomes that come out of it. And this is something that in a story you don't have to think about, right? Like when you're writing a story, the story is the thing that you wrote. When you're writing a game, especially a role-playing game, you have to acknowledge that at any given moment, there are multiple possibilities coming out of everything. So when you go into an encounter with a goal, it can be a yes or no question. And then that's a very simple win-lose thing. It's like either you beat the goblins or you were driven back, or you beat the goblins or you die, whatever it is. If you start looking at that in terms of, okay, there is a goal. The goal is to get past the goblins. There is obviously a very important element of properly identifying the goal. You know, so that you if you narrowly define the goal, you are limiting the player's response to it. If the players walk into a room and there's goblins in the room and the goal is kill all the goblins, then you have sort of, and you design for that, where the players walk into the room and they see their goal as, we need to get through this room. Like the goblins are not the goal. The goal is just, is getting through the room. The goblins are in the way. The players could kill them, or the players could sneak past them, or the players could negotiate with them, or the players could frighten them away, or whatever. So, you know, identifying the goal becomes a very important activity, which is basically the same as what the dramatic question was to begin with. It was just identifying what's really at stake here. What is the party really trying to do? And then it's also recognizing that there are potentially multiple outcomes. Like if you know that the players, they walked into the room, they see the goblins, and now they want to get through the room, and they're considering the different ways they can do it, and you consider the different ways they can do it. So you might acknowledge that the players will likely either fight the goblins, sneak past the goblins, or negotiate with the goblins, or frighten the goblins away, right? Those are like the four stances that the players will likely take. Then each one of those now represents a different outcome. Like obviously if they kill the goblins aren't there anymore unless some of the goblins escape, or unless, you know, what might the goblins do? They might retreat and then they'll shore up some other room or whatever, or the players might be driven back, you know, the players, which means they might end up captive, yada, yada, yada. You can see how this can get very complicated very quickly. But then the other thing that the dramatic question leaves out, and this is a very important game design trick, is I have a room and I know the players are walking into this room with the goal of getting to the other side of the room because they're just trying to get through the dungeon or get the treasure or escape or whatever. And there's goblins in the room because there's goblins in the room. And I want them to, like, I only want to deal with combat or intimidation, right? I don't want them talking. I don't want them sneaking. For whatever reason, okay? One of the reasons, by the way, is just because I don't want to have to write four different sets of encounters or four different encounters here. So you decide these are the two outcomes that are available. Okay, then the trick becomes presenting the goblins in such a way that they either invite intimidation or invite combat. Right, and so you might, it depends on the party's demeanor. If the party is hesitant, the goblins will be threatening and start talking about robbing them. It's like, maybe we just kill you and take your stuff, kind of a thing, right? Oh, look, we can just kill these guys. Look, treasure and stuff. And if the party goes in and they immediately take a strong stance, then the goblins are weak-willed, and even though the captain of the goblins is trying to mouth off, it's clear that his minions are nervous and they're backing away and don't want to follow him into battle. And so now, by presenting it in those two ways, depending on how the party initially approaches it, now you are, the term is choice architecture. You have now designed that choice to suggest approaches. And then you can write the adventure around those approaches fairly secure in the idea that the players will probably take one of those approaches. Likewise, if I want them to sneak through the room, I will suggest, like, I will design a room that has concealing objects and allow them to enter the room without the goblins having a direct line of sight to them, so they can see that there is a sneaking route before the goblins notice them. Those are the things I need to do to get the players to think we could sneak through here, right? So all of this, everything I just said, because I warned you this was going to be a complicated speech, is why I no longer talk in terms of dramatic question and source of conflict, because that's too narrow and it leaves out a lot of design possibilities. Okay? It is not that I have abandoned those ideas because they were bad ideas. It is just that over time, things have become more sophisticated. The other thing I will point out again is that true scenario design is not for everyone. I mean, everybody is welcome to read it and to use it, but it's no longer about, here's how you build a dungeon adventure for your friends. This is now about, like, do you want to master adventure building? Do you want to build adventures where you can build a room and be reasonably assured that your party will take either one of these two approaches? You know, do you want to build an adventure in such a way that the players never go off the rails, because it just never occurs to them to go off the rails, but at the same time, they're completely acting with their own agency? It's just that the way you're framing everything is showing them the possibilities to win or lose. You know, it's that kind of thing, which is what video game designers do. Every time they splash a coat of paint on a wall to show you you can climb it, that's the sort of shit they're doing. You know, when they make a exit memorable that with a lock on it, so that when you find the key, the first thing you think about is, now I can go through the memorable door. Okay, it's that same sort of thing. You build it into your own game design, and once you get good at it, it actually makes your life a lot easier, because you're very rarely left scrambling and having to make up huge chunks of an adventure because the players did something bizarre that you didn't think of them doing. Though, no matter what, your players will always eventually surprise you. Okay, it's not like you're making a game where the outcome is assured, especially because you're obviously building with multiple outcomes in mind. Can the players win this? Can the players lose that? What does it mean to win? What does it mean to lose? What are the seven different outcomes of this adventure that are likely? And what is it that the players do that get them these different outcomes and things like that? You know, it's not as easy as just saying, you know, now I'm just railroading the players into the one outcome. I'm just limiting the possibility space to make it easier to play so that the players will figure out how to get through the adventure and are more likely to win and feel brilliant doing it, while at the same time also limiting the number of possibilities I have to write. I don't remember what the question was, but somewhere... Oh, yeah. The point is that over the years of writing all this shit, my ideas have evolved. I don't necessarily throw away anything I used to say, but things have grown more complicated over time. But the stuff I'm saying in True Scenario Designery is me talking to a different audience than the people I've been talking to earlier. Okay? You know, the angry open world game stuff, like here's how to build a simple open world campaign and just get it off the ground and just start running it. That's still there, and anybody can do that. Anybody can just start up an open world game like that. But what I'm talking about with True Scenario Designery is like, okay, let's sit down and like let's try to make art. Okay. Somewhere in there, I was probably answers. And I think that's it. So that's pretty much all the questions that I was able to... I really don't... Noided wanted to know why I hate the Fae. I don't really hate the Fae. I just have very little interest in them. They just don't engage me. What I do hate, like, I hate the Fae are environmentalists now. In general, environmentalism is stupid in D&D. It's a dumb idea. But the problem is, again, D&D... there is this concept called modernism. It is viewing everything through a modern lens, judging everything by modern standards, only being able to imagine the world in terms of the modern world that you live in. D&D has gone very modernist. Okay, it's all modern issues, modern ideas. You know, the topics of the day are what's on display, which is why Druids are environmentalist. It's why we have all of the discussions about the moral gray areas around orcs and things like that, is because we're now viewing everything through a modern lens. We are not entering into the fantasy world. Okay, we're not pushing ourselves out of our modern world. And that is fine, and people enjoy that, and it is fun. But at the same time, there are timeless concepts that transcend the zeitgeist at the heart of fantasy, which is why fantasy has endured for, the concept of fantasy goes all the way back to the Romantic period, where you had books like The Death of Arthur and, you know, things like that. You know, all the romanticization of like the Arthurian legend and the Robin Hood story and stuff. You know, the origins of fantasy are as much there as they are in Tolkien. And those deal with a lot of timeless issues that are still important to us heart and soul, but which kind of get crowded out because we get lost in these temporal issues. Very temporal, very fleeting issues of modern day, you know. And I don't really care for that very much. And like the Fae have fallen victim to it because the Fae represent nature. And the thing is, no, the Fae are not nature spirits. And in fact, so this is the weird thing too. Like there's two different ideas in D&D that got crammed into the Fae. Number one is goblins and red caps and all the basically malevolent or at least amoral things that lurked everywhere in the world that wasn't a well-lit home during daylight hours. The world was just full of malevolence It was tricksy and it would screw you at every turn. You know, those are your kobolds, your goblins, your red caps, your will-o'-the-wisps, your jack-o'-the-wisps, whatever. You know, all that stuff that all represented basically the everything that was lurking in the dark. Every mysterious thing that would go wrong. Somehow, that got crammed together with all of the classical mythology nature spirits, the naiads and the dryads and the other ads, you know, which were actually, I mean, they're not really demigods, but they were supernatural entities that were personifications of nature. But they were actually small gods, right? The naiads were the small river gods, and the dryads were the small tree gods, and yada, yada, yada. Okay, so somehow those two ideas got conflated together into the D&D Fae, which now already means that the Fae are kind of a mess. Then to elves are in a weird place with, and so are gnomes with relation to the Fae, because they sort of graduated out of being Fae, you know, in sort of the fantasy genre. Elves became people. So they couldn't be Fae anymore, but we still kind of put them in this weird space where they're Fae adjacent. So Fae is kind of a mess. Look, I mean, if we go back to it, I do love the stories of ghosties and ghoulies and long-leggedy beasties that go bump in the night. Okay, from that perspective, I like the Fae. I like the idea that there is malevolence and amorality and just basic lack of care for humanity lurking everywhere in the world, you know? But then again, that's also just all the monsters. I mean, there was a conversation earlier about bugbears in one of the channels, and that, you know, and bugbears were the boogeyman, right? They come from this bugbear boogeyman. They come from the same linguistic root. That's what it was. It was the evil thing that lurked in the forests that would murder people who traveled in the forest. Just like, it would jump out. You shouldn't have gone into the woods after dark. You just got murdered. There you go. You know, it was the thing that lurked in the dark. It's the monster hiding under the bed. It's the monster hiding in the closet. But it was the thing that lurked if you went out of doors after dark and wandered the roads because you should be home. Okay. So the bugbear was Fae. Goblins were Fae. You know, now we start to get into the whole Norse versus Germanic versus Celtic / Gaelic versus classical. And it all becomes a big mess anyway. So the Fae has become a hodgepodge of anything remotely nature-y. And they're also, in general, for my tastes, too damn flighty and way too sympathetic. Okay, you know, it's all friendly and delightful comedic spirits of the natural world. And it's like, go to hell. No, it should be trying to kill you. Okay. Now, it should be things that are basically murdering you in a pit and then dipping their hat in your blood to dye their hats red. That's Fae. So anyway, all right. Any other questions? Anybody want to know anything else? I'm approaching the 90-minute mark, so probably good that I'm getting close to a wrap-up. Fae create tickweed. Yeah, I suppose. So, all right, so I want to apologize again because I wasn't really super prepared for this. Things kind of got away from me again. But nonetheless, you know, things are moving toward improvement and I do want to dial back the doom and gloom a bit. And I know I said, you know, if I can't figure this out, I'm going out of business in December. And that's not, you know, in January. That's really not likely to happen. I'm getting a handle on things, but I was very, very down on myself last month. But it does mean I can't just let things go either. Like, things do have to keep improving. But it has been a rough month, and I do apologize that this got pushed off, and then I showed up completely unprepared. But nonetheless, I hope there was some interesting and edifying discussion in all of this. I think there were a few interesting topics, some fun questions got answered. And I will do better next month, but meanwhile, next week, I will be doing basically at the same time, which is, it'll be Wednesday night, and it'll be, I guess that's 8 p.m. Eastern time, so 7 p.m. Central time, and I have no idea what other times that might be. And remember, the clocks change this weekend if you're in one of those places, one of the smart, good places that changes clocks back and forth, because that's the proper way it should be. But next week I will be doing a Slap Chat for members of Club Slapdash. It is going to be informal, but there's not going to be a whole lot of question and answer. Instead, I am going to take y'all through what the design statement for Slapdash has evolved into. What are my goals for Slapdash for players of Slapdash? And what are my goals for Slapdash for game masters of Slapdash? So, because that's a real, you know, as I'm relaunching that project now, it is a really good place to start to iron out exactly what the hell it is I'm making here, you know, which is how you start designing anything, as I already said, which sorts of takes me back full circle. Nonetheless, thank you everybody for hanging out. Thank you for your ongoing patience. Thank you for the support and the encouragement, which continues to help me go through this very difficult time in my life. There have been a couple of very generous people in the last month who have gone a little bit above and beyond in their support, and I am really grateful for that. I don't want to call anyone out by name, obviously, without explicit permission or put anyone on the spot or anything like that. And I really don't like to talk numbers or anything, but that was really tremendously appreciated. Though you, who you are, you know who you are. It meant a lot to me. And also, I've received a number of messages from people who are just letting me know that they appreciate my work and that it is making their gaming better, which also helps a great deal. So thank you to everyone for all of that. And I hope I will see you all again next month.